This is Mile High.
Do I want to tell the story or do I want to show the message?
You've got a lot of work to do between Mile High.
The time has come where we can know.
We have a responsibility, an ethical and moral responsibility.
We have to do it better in order to move people along.
Up, down, inside out.
If you get your mind right, it is not. It is a receiver of thought. Because love is my first technique.
It's now time for the show.
Welcome to the next segment of the Mile High Philosophy Summit. We are so excited that you joined us for this. This is the largest online philosophy summit in chiropractic history by the number of people that have registered. We are so psyched. And I am here with one of my good friends, one of my few long-term friends in chiropractic, Dr. Simon Senzon. He has the Tick Institute. We're going to talk about that. And we're going to refine some both philosophical and historical concepts. Dr. Simon, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, sure. My problem. Pleasure. Great to be here. Night with the kids last night.
Anytime we get to talk to you, we're really excited, and you have so much value that you add. The information that you add in the TIC membership is phenomenal. Let's just mention real briefly what that is and then dive into our topic.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, people could become a member at TIC, the Institute Chiropractic. It's institutechiro.com, and they just get hundreds of hours of content as part of the membership. Discount CE, they get me questions, and we've got forums. It's really an amazing service.
And I have to say, you've done such a gift with that and so many things you do for chiropractic. I know your impetus is that there's a lot of miseducation, myths and such about chiropractic history taught in chiropractic colleges, unfortunately, right now, that you want people to have clear information so that people are knowledgeable for generations to come. And I appreciate that so much about you, and I know so many others do. So I think a good place to start would be this concept that really I feel you brought forth, if I'm not correct, let me know, brought forth of the waves of chiropractic philosophers.
Yeah, well, this is something I've been focusing on now as part of that idea to really give people the same body of knowledge. And it seemed like a really easy way for people to start to understand the history of the ideas and also the schools of thought in chiropractic. So one way to look at that is how people from different time periods in chiropractic base their ideas on the last set of books or teachers. So I've really looked at this as these different waves of philosophy in the profession, which is just a great way to understand, you know, how we got to where we are today.
Excellent. Can you describe what the waves are and where they each sourced from? Because they were pivotal on a different person that led certain ideas, if I understand correctly.
Yeah, I like to think of it in terms of the first wave, which was really D.D. Palmer and the first chiropractic authors, which were students of D.D. and students of B.J. So between, say, like 1907 and 1915, there were about 10 books that got published. Most of them were by school leaders, from BJ and DD to also Smith and Langworthy and Davis and Loban and Howard. So all those guys had schools and had textbooks. And then the next wave came after them, which was really the first Green Book authors, Firth and Burrich and Vetter, who went on and started their own school in Indianapolis in the 20s and the 30s. Also Jim Drain's books came out in the 20s. So that was the next wave from about 1915 to 1927 when Stevenson's book came out. And then I think of the third wave really from Stevenson to about the 1940s where BJ wrote Bigness of the Fellow Within. Also Drain wrote a book at that time, Man Tomorrow. And then there are some other really important texts that came out during that period, chiropractic researchers. Werner's book came out in the early 50s. And then the 50s and 60s, I think of it as sort of a new renaissance where these new researchers were looking at the ideas in chiropractic, but they were going back to D.D. Palmer for the first time. So there was a real impetus within a lot of the different schools to integrate D.D. Palmer's theories with the latest ideas in neurophysiology. So that really actually spurred a whole new wave of thought and theory in the 70s and 80s. So there was a whole other wave that emerged when chiropractors really started to look more at peer-reviewed literature and try to have academic conferences. So there was some really interesting dynamics at that period. And then the next wave really happened when CCE showed up on the scene, which is now going back almost 50 years since CCE became the sole accreditor for the schools in the U.S., which really caused kind of a fracture in the chiropractic discourse. So that's when like Sherman College came around that time. Life Chiropractic emerged around that time. So there were sort of splits in the straight chiropractic community. There were also these new academics showing up on the scene like Joe Keating and all these other authors. So there was a whole new polarization and a whole new level of academic discourse. And that's really gone on into the 90s. And then I think of the latest wave really in terms of some of the latest philosophers and theorists out there today. We've got books by Rob Sinnott. We've got other history books about D.D. Palmer that have come out in the last few years. There's the ACP program and the LCP program. And there's some really good academic writing happening. And plus some of the books I've done and articles in the last few years. So when you look at it in that context, that's kind of a big overview of the history of ideas in chiropractic, kind of a snapshot. But it just gives you a place to kind of stick your teeth into. Like, if I really want to understand these ideas, let me focus on one time period and see if I can really understand what people were thinking then and how that was influenced by the time period before it and how that influenced the next time period. Which is a whole different way to think of it. Instead of just like, let me learn Stevenson's text or let me read a B.J. Palmer book, it's more of like putting those in the bigger picture of the ideas.
Excellent, excellent. And again, the resources that you've put out have been so valuable. I think it would be remiss if we didn't mention something, since the timing of this interview and this summit, philosophically, would be remiss if we don't touch on the coronavirus and the Spanish flu. I know you've done some posts that were very inspiring. Can you say anything about chiropractic in both these times?
Sure. Yeah, I did post a whole bunch. We've got a private page on Facebook for TIC, right, which is not just for members, and we posted a bunch there. And, you know, one thing I posted a few years ago that I published actually, last year it came out, there was one of the articles that I did in the Journal of Chiropractic Humanities. I looked at the emergence of acute and chronic chiropractic care, which were new kind of methods that emerged. And one of them, really, acute care really showed up as part of the Spanish flu pandemic. Someone like Jim Drain, who had published several books. He was the head of the Texas Chiropractic College. But at the time, during the flu pandemic of 1918, he had a private practice in rural Texas. He took a horse and buggy out to the patients who were dying. And this is a whole different context for the way chiropractic emerged. Chiropractors took care of the sickest people. They took care of the people that the medical establishment had given up on, and they saw miraculous cures, miraculous changes, people restored to their health. And Drain, he wrote about some of these experiences, and he said he would go to their houses and he would adjust them through the night, and he would monitor their innate recoil. He would notice their breathing, he would notice their response, he would notice the thermography, and he was able to track how often they should continue to get adjusted. And he gave some protocols, like based on how well they were responding, whether they were on the trajectory to die, which a lot of people were back then he would adjust them more frequently, like every hour or every 2 hours or every six hours or more, depending on how they were responding. So that was one protocol. Then there was Ashworth, whose family started the Cleveland schools. She hired a driver who would take her from house to house, and she was taking care of the flu patients like that. So, and you know, these chiropractors, they had to report their cases to the state and county boards. So a lot of their cases were documented. So when people say, oh, that's just kind of this myth, this, a lot of it was actually documented facts that the chiropractors had less deaths in their patient bases. And this one guy, Forster, who was one of the leaders of National Chiropractic College in that time period, he said that it was because of the flu pandemic of 1918 that chiropractic entered a whole new stratosphere of acceptance in the culture, because people saw that their loved ones were living, and it really changed the whole perception of the profession.
That's
so, and, yeah, it's, and when we look at that today, it's totally different context. But I mainly posted those things to inspire people to know that, you know, we can rise to this challenge in really interesting and powerful ways with our patient bases.
Excellent, excellent. Thank you so much for sharing that. And this is the kind of stuff that people have in the TIC membership. I cannot emphasize it enough. Let's talk about innate intelligence. Innate intelligence, when I went to chiropractic school, was what we talked about all the time, right? What does innate do? What does universal do? There's less talk about innate in chiropractic circles, sadly. And so one of your areas is there's language differentiation relative to the terminology of innate and universal. Can you help people get a better understanding of these terms?
Yeah, sure, sure. And I really started to understand this because of where we went to school. We went to Sherman, both of us, and Sherman was really pioneered a new way to talk about innate, which a lot of people don't realize, which was, let's focus on the body's ability to self-heal and self-organize, which was a different way to define innate intelligence than the way you'll read about it if you read B.J. Palmer, or if you read D.D. Palmer, or if you read Sid Williams even, right? So there was a whole different approach to innate, and that was part of the confusion that I found in the literature. B.J. Palmer and D.D. Palmer used the same word, innate intelligence, or the same phrase, or two words, to describe spirit, soul, why the living system is alive versus dead, right? Which can relate soul and spirit. But also, when you look at how D.D. Palmer originally wrote about it, it was to talk about how the body was adapting to changes, right? So when he first wrote about it, he was talking about how the bones develop osteophytes as responses to environmental pressure and environmental stressors. And then a few years later, he added the spiritual stuff. So one thing I got from that differentiation that we got at Sherman was that really we were using one term to describe different levels of being. One level is the body's ability to self-organize. Another level is spirit, soul. Another level was the relationship between intuitive insights and the educated brain's ability to receive that. And BJ described that as information from the innate wisdom to the conscious thinking brain. So by differentiating it and owning those terms, we can move the chiropractic discourse forward. Because what happens is a lot of people want to just throw out all the spiritual stuff that BJ and DD wrote about it and just talk about the body's ability to organize, which was important to preserve the importance of vertebral subluxation, right? To say, let's just focus on that and not worry about all the weird spiritual stuff. The problem is the critics can pull out any of those quotes any day of the week and say, oh, you're using that term. Well, this is how it's defined. Mm-hmm. And if we don't differentiate how we're defining our terms and how we're understanding those original definitions and describing those today, then we leave ourselves open to the subluxation deniers, the baseless attacks, all the stuff that goes with it. So one of the reasons why I did that was to really establish a philosophical and a linguistic foundation for the philosophy to keep developing.
Yes, and I think also around that time and connected to Sherman College, and again, please refine or correct what I'm saying if I'm speaking incorrectly, the Triune of Life, Reggie Gull connected intimately with Sherman College, right? That Triune of Life really discusses innate intelligence in the vein of what I believe you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and Reggie was really the pioneer of that differentiation, really. And I think of it as the difference between Reggie Gold and Sid Williams, and how the kind of straight community split. Because Sid was still talking about the innate talking to the educated, and Reggie was really saying, let's not even talk about that. Let's just focus on subluxation because it's in danger of being lost in the profession.
Right, right.
So it's really how can we take those insights and develop them even further? That's really what I've been focused on now for quite a bit.
Excellent. I'd like to ask you something else, and if you're comfortable talking about it, I think you'll be, because this innate intelligence concept, the concept of intellectual adaptation, and that relates to innate intelligence. I think it relates to what we're talking about. And I know a lot of people haven't even heard of that term.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, it's... I don't know if we have enough time, really, to go into it. Why don't we save it for our next 30
save
minutes?
Save it for next time? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And then saying with this, innate contacting educated... So right. In the model that we're differentiating, compared to, like, I have a book here of how does, from BJ, a pamphlet that I got it when we were at Sherman, how does innate contact educated, how do we define that in the context of what you're talking about?
Yeah, well, it's complicated, right? So really, I mean, when we think of it in the context of BJ Palmer, he was writing the really, really advanced ideas about that. At the same time that Maslow was starting to write about humanistic psychology and his hierarchy of self-actualizing people, right? So B.J. Palmer should really be understood along the lines of one of the leading humanistic theorists of our time. So I think one way to think of it is in terms of inspiration, you know, he wrote about it. He used the same term, innate intelligence, which I think is fine as long as we can just include our definitions in sequence, right? Instead of saying innate intelligence is just this, we need to specify and say innate intelligence is really a multi-leveled thing. And really, if we're thinking about it ontologically, it's like a multiple object. It has different meanings to different people based on what they've learned, how they're thinking, their way of thinking. And we need to be able to navigate that complicated territory. So it becomes a really deep and rich philosophical discussion. Perhaps the forum could help inspire that to go further.
And again, we're doing this so that chiropractic students and chiropractors that maybe didn't even think about this because they may not have learned it in chiropractic school or in their education, get their wheels turning. So then if we're talking about innate intelligence and defining terms and having more clarity, innate and universal, universal, and it's a subset of universal. How can we more understand the distinguishing between the two?
Yeah, that's where it gets even juicier and more complicated, right? Because, you know, we could talk about universal. A lot of times I'll find chiropractors write about universal and they want to make these distinctions that D.D. Palmer didn't make, right? And D.D. Palmer had a totally different worldview when he brought up the concept of universal. He was writing about it from an experience, right? He had spent decades practicing as a spiritualist, and the spiritualists, they had a whole doctrine of infinite intelligence that was part of their kind of Bible. There's this little book called The Spiritualist Manual, and it starts with infinite intelligence as one of the main principles. And that goes back to the 1890s. So they would put themselves in these trance states and these meditative states and these hypnotic states and have this oneness with all of creation. And then they had this philosophical explanation for what they were talking about. So it wasn't like Stevenson was just deducing this idea by looking around and saying, oh, all the trees are organized, all the grass is organized, that's universal intelligence, right? That's one way we can get to that, but that's not how D.D. Palmer got to it, right? That he got to it from the inside, not from observing the outside. So it's an important distinction, because then when we're talking about innate intelligence as a part of that, we're talking about this very holistic understanding of reality, of who we are, of our whole worldview. So instead of it becoming just something that you believe because you learned it, it becomes something that you know because you're having an experience of it, which is, again, from the inside or the outside.
And then it's also coming from different lenses of observing the world and experiencing the world.
Exactly, yeah. And yeah. Which are both true, right? So that's the key, right? Or they all have their own levels of truth to them. So how can we integrate that into a framework, which is really one of the focuses that we have at the Institute of Chiropractic. In the Institute of Chiropractic, the goal there is to really develop an integral framework and to offer a philosophical framework for people to put all of this together as a profession and really develop a whole new way that we can develop the philosophy and move the profession forward.
Yes, agreed. Another thing that comes up, and I know when we were in chiropractic college at Sherman, a phrase that was said frequently, it might have been Betty Gilardi or one of the many instructors, okay, which was that the chiropractor thrusts and innate adjusts, right? I remember hearing that over and over again. I thought it was such a wonderful and beautiful thing to say in terms of giving credit to where credit's due. However, I don't think a lot of chiropractic students understand that philosophically, or even get, and when I say students, I don't necessarily mean people in school, because we're all chiropractic students, right? So, you're a chiropractic student. So how can that, the chiropractor thrust, innate adjust, apply this innate intelligence and universal intelligence?
Sure. Yeah, you know, I think, again, that's, for me, when that concept really fits in with understanding the inherent intelligence within the organism, understanding not just the philosophy of it, but also what is a self-organizing system? What's the science of self-organization or nonlinear dynamics of a living system? Because those ideas really were developed alongside the philosophy of chiropractic.
Right.
So the idea is, when you're putting the input into the system at the right time, at the right place, with the right amount of force, then the system could optimally use it. And the organism is going to try to adapt the best it can to any input that comes into the system. So the idea there that BJ Palmer really developed was the more specific you can be, the more accurate you can be, then the more innate is going to be able to accept that force, right? Excellent. But again, it was, but to understand that really specifically and in the context of system science, I think takes a lot of the BS out of it, right? Because people have used that to say that's just a cop out, right? And chiropractors can use that as a cop out. Oh, I don't need to be specific with my adjusting because I'll just put in a force and I can hit them with a shovel and then they will take care of the rest. Right. So again, it's that nuance of understanding the philosophy, the science, and the art all together.
Yes, people can use it as a permission to not be accountable. Right.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Versus, you can use it as more reverence for what you're working with, as in the honor of the calling of being a chiropractor.
Totally. Yeah.
Which would be two different ways to interpret that. So now you instruct, help, teach in so many ways. I'll leave this as an open question to you. Is there a particular chiropractic philosophical point that you get asked frequently that you'd like to use this moment to clear up or help people understand better? I know that's very wide open.
Yeah, that's wide open. People ask me a lot of historical questions a lot of times, a lot of really weird nuanced things. One thing I'd love to share with people, and I'm going to ask the Chiropractic History Journal permission to post my newest article, which came out over the summer, so everybody has a chance to read it. And it's an important article. It's probably one of the most important articles in the history of chiropractic in terms of chiropractic history, because it's the first article that I wrote with the PhD program that I'm in right now, and I wrote it with a scientist, and it's a history article about the Morikubo trial, which was really an incredible look at what it is that happened at the trial, like what are the actual facts. It's one of the main distortions in the chiropractic literature that I've noticed is this idea that the philosophy of chiropractic was invented as a legal ruse because of the Morikubo trial. And you see that in the literature a lot, and you see that sort of as an underlying myth in the subluxation deniers, that philosophy was just something that got invented so that chiropractors can be legal in court and win court cases. And we're able to show systematically, scientifically, in a reproducible way why that's not true and what really happened at the Morikubo trial and how that started to affect the literature of the last 40 years. So that's one thing I'd love people to get. I think we'll be posting it soon once I get official permission and people can look at it and get the facts. And so then when you see that kind of thing, if you hear it in a classroom or you see it on Facebook, you'll have the facts that that's just not true, and let's redirect the conversation towards empirical facts, what I'm calling evidence-based history.
Good, good. We're running out of time. I want to give a moment for you to be able to mention about the TIC program again. Can you just share again what people get with that? And then I'll have one more question I believe we'll have time for.
Yeah, sure. So when you become a member at TIC, you get into the back end of the website, which has hundreds of videos, short videos, longer videos, pretty much every live class that I've taught in the last 10 years just about, as well as all of the short videos that I've recorded over the last few years, these what I call them weekly ticks, which I've done about 70 of those. I've done just dozens and dozens of little videos. So you get all of that. You get a forum. You get discounts on books. You get discounts on CE credits, online CE credits. And you get access to me and questions answered and a whole community of chiropractors who are really getting all of these same facts together at the same time all over the world, which is, I think, really the essence of it.
I think it's vital, and I was very glad when you launched that around the time at Mile High, many years ago. So, quick question. One of my favorite, you introduced me to J.R. Drain and introduced many people. One of my favorite statements in there, if we can have a short answer to this, was that subluxation, that J.R. Drain says in that book, Chiro Thoughts, subluxation is the manifestation of the cause of disease. Some of my favorite statements I read in that book. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah.
Physical manifestation of the cause of disease.
Yeah, and that term, that phrase actually goes back to about 1905 when they had one of the very first meetings of the UCA. I think it was 1905 or 1907. It was right around when the UCA was forming. The chiropractors wanted to clarify what subluxation was and distinguish it from disease, the disease process. So B.J. Palmer used it, Firth used it, I think, in his green book, and those guys were all from that same first generation, which was just to make that differentiation that this is a representation of the cause. Which takes it a step out of, you know, that the medical mindset of we're trying to find the thing to fix, right? Or we're trying to find the symptom. They wanted to, you know, really just distinguish that this is a unique worldview. And that's important, I think, that a lot of people don't get the distinction of how it's a whole different paradigm than the medical paradigm.
Yes, and I find that point such a very important point that most people don't realize. I think it will impact their philosophy, science, and art when they then have the realization of that. So, Simon, I just have to say, for all of chiropractic profession, thank you so much for the work that you do, the energy you put in. We are all so grateful, and I have to say again, as you know, I know everybody's going to be going to the next segment. We have several segments of sessions here. Definitely check out the TIC membership. It's very much worth the investment, and it will pay off in dividends in your knowledge and wisdom and your ability to help people. Thank you, Simon.
My pleasure.